At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
It's the Wonky Show. We're talking budget day, student complaints in the pandemic, pensions, and we have the latest dispatches from the culture wars. It's all coming up.
But as Debbie pointed out, a lot of these things are very subjective, and therefore that means that individuals will have individual complaints that are very specific to their circumstances. You know, what a course or course leader may or may not have done in response to this that may or may not be deemed efficient, that may or may not have meant an individual has taken the time to go down the route of the ombudsman. And so I suppose, you know, the long tail question is more...
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Editor-in-Chief, Mark Leach, recording from our cutting-edge recording studio, or spare room as we call it around here. And joining me to unpack the red box of policy goodies this week are two fabulous guests. In Nottingham, we have Alex Favier, Director of Global and Political Affairs at the University of Nottingham. Alex, your hire of the week, please.
I think it's mostly been dinosaur toy related, as my 4-month-old daughter has discovered the joy of objects to play with, and that has occupied her for at least half an hour before she's realised that she should be upset about something else. So that's definitely my highlight.
And from Team Wonky, it's Debbie McVitty, Wonky's editor. Debbie, your highlight of the week.
I'm gonna have two bites of the cherry. One is our admissions event on Tuesday, which was just fantastic. Loads of really rich and interesting debate, and I think changed my thinking about the likelihood of us ever moving to a PQA model. But you know, more on that on the site in due course, I'm sure. The other one is when I pressed buy on some delicious treats from Betty's in Yorkshire, because do you know what, life is really sad right now, and everyone needs treats. So biscuits are coming to our house.
And we start the week in Westminster, where not only we've had a budget, of course, but a glimpse at the future funding agency, ARIA, and lots of other bits and bobs. Alex, talk us through it.
Okay, Mark, I mean, essentially, this is a status quo budget from the perspective of higher education. In large degree, we haven't found the kind of surprise changes or rabbits in hats, as I believe they're technically called, that we've seen elsewhere. But in terms of the kind of main things for the sector, the positive visa changes to the global talent route, and there's an excellent blog on this on Wonky. There is a freeze on the tuition fee cap, which has been buried in the red book. Again, you know, control F and search for universities is always a time-honored approach to analyzing any budget. The ARIA funding announcement, which we'll get onto in a second, which was very heavily pre-briefed in recent weeks, which is quite interesting. But actually, in terms of the economic development piece, universities across the country will be looking at this, not least because we are, of course, all heavily involved in all elements of leveling up and economic growth now. And so new Help to Grow funds, a future fund, breakthroughs. Some of us are involved in Freeports as well. So lots there in the margins, but nothing too substantial for the sector in this particular budget, I don't think.
But Debbie, it's the meta narrative, isn't it, about I guess where we're heading over the next 3 years or so?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are essentially two ways to read, you know, big statements like this one. And the traditional Wonky way is to kind of, I guess, to do that control F thing and look for, you know, where it says universities and sort of say what's in here for universities. But I think the relative absence of universities from specific funding commitments and policy announcements shouldn't be taken as a lack of endorsement of the vital role of universities in helping to deliver on the government's policy agenda. And I think, you know, reading the political winds, I think it is, I would commend the, not the Red Book actually, but the Plan for Growth, the Build Back Better plan that the government published alongside the budget, which sets out in reasonable amount of detail what the big long-term plan to get, you know, essentially get Britain back moving and also get the government elected at the next election. And that is grounded in things that are absolutely central to what universities do: place, levelling up, net zero carbon emissions, innovation, skills, and infrastructure. And these are, and all through that book, what you see is, you know, we have world leading universities delivering cutting edge science. We want to be a science superpower. We want to be global Britain. We have, you know, internationally impactful universities. We have places, we have universities in our places, and they are delivering on these things. So there's not a sense here, I think, that universities are perceived as marginal. In fact, if anything, I think they're perceived as very much central to the government's long-term agenda. And I think there's perhaps an opportunity here. I mean, lots of decisions will be deferred to the spending review in the autumn. And of course, universities are, in England particularly, staring down the barrel of potential funding cuts to fees. And, you know, there's a kind of moment here to redouble efforts to convince Treasury that if the government wants to deliver on its big reset, it absolutely needs to back universities.
I think that the as you say, the big control F exercise is going to happen in the autumn with the comprehensive spending review, where we're promised a final wrap up of this question of fees and auger and all the rest. But, you know, I guess we'll believe it when we see it. It's been promised before. I think part of the other interest, I think, from this week has been the economic forecast from the OBR, hasn't it? Because what we see is definitely a kind of little post COVID boost, but then perhaps several years of quite anemic growth. And that does have real world effects on kind of every part of the economy. I mean, one of them is also the associated return on student loans. The OBR predicting, as a result of all that, the RAB charge is going to rise from 53.2 to 53.6, which is a substantial amount when we look at the, you know, just the kind of tens of billions that entails. So I guess my question is, to the two of you, is there a danger that we're heading into, you know, difficult economic territory that's going to mean fewer graduates paying back their student loans, which is going to put further pressure on the funding system? Could we end up on the other side of this parliament with a much bigger look at the question of fees and funding and how all these kind of bits link together?
I don't think so, on the basis that the government sort of approach the RAB charges, if we don't look at it too closely, does it really exist? And I would suspect that will continue. I mean, not least if we see a change in government. I suspect that this is one of those things, a bit like social care reform, that will just keep on getting kicked down, or skills, that will keep on getting kicked down the political agenda, with reviews and reviews of reviews and then reviews of reviews of reviews. I think the wider kind of economic malaise is going to have an impact on universities for sure, but mostly because of the impact on graduates and the availability of jobs and the value of degree agenda that the government is very closely linking to employability and earnings. I think that also universities' ability to access easy capital for either improvement or expansion plans. You know, we are all looking at what does a future campus look like at the moment, and some of that is going to require investment. Certainly, you know, universities have spent a substantial amount making campuses COVID secure and facilities able to be used during the pandemic. And I suspect that whatever happens over the next year and a half will require that investment. I suspect that wider economic malaise may impact our ability to do that, or certainly some institutions' ability to do that.
And Debbie, this also links to the kind of what looks like a bit of a moving away from the industrial strategy, or the rhetoric around industrial strategy. We just learnt today, actually, that the government's disbanding the Industrial Strategy Council, which had lots of big names and was seen as a bit of a focal point for some of this work. I mean, what comes in its place if industrial strategy is being put aside?
Well, I'm not sure. I think it's more that the 2017 version of the industrial strategy is being put aside. And I think, you know, certain probably bits of thinking around that relating to kind of investment in particular challenges and sectors. But actually, I mean, again, in the plan for growth, there's quite a lot there about things like investment in life sciences, supercomputing, you know, there is attention to particular bits of industry. But I suppose this government is perhaps a bit more wide ranging in its thinking around place. So I think, you know, the lens that it's bringing to bear are things like place and, green energy and, innovation generally, looking at it from a kind of, you know, sort of a whole infrastructure perspective, rather than perhaps specific industries as being the kind of focal point. So I suppose rather than saying this is the end of industrial strategy per se, it's sort of saying this is industrial strategy aligned to economic strategy with a slightly different lens and focus. So in some ways, this is about killing off what, you know, what feels like a sort of redundant piece of policy. Although it's, I suppose, a bit frustrating for anyone who has invested in kind of doing things around that particular industrial strategy. But I think there's also still a lot of carryover. You know, there's still that focus on skills and apprenticeships, higher technical, all the things that, you know, were sort of known to be underpinning for the earlier version of the industrial strategy have popped up again in Skills for Jobs and all the, and the kind of sense that, you know, that is an area for investment. So I think it's an evolution rather than a total U-turn on that.
And on research and science, I guess the big glitzy thing of this week and really this month is ARIA, the new UK DARPA, the big new science, blue sky science agency. It's awfully interesting. I mean, Dominic Cummings was pushing this, and a lot of people thought that it might fall away after his departure of Number 10. But they are going ahead with it, and it's garnered some interesting headlines over the last couple of weeks because of the secrecy surrounding it. It's not going to be subject to FOI or normal procurement rules. It can't be abolished once this bill's been passed for 10 years or something like that. So they're not going to be able to chop and change it. I mean, Alex, do you see any opportunities here for universities?
I mean, I do wonder where it's going to be based. Maybe it's going to be sort of, you know, in the northeast between sort of in a small town outside of Durham, given the association with its kind of its founder in many ways. I mean, there's a huge amount of opportunities in this. And I mean, it was interesting when it was being floated, some universities were sort of having a debate about whether they'd want it to be located near them, because this is exactly the kind of big thing that would potentially suck the oxygen out of place-based investments in research and innovation. But again, the co-location principle does also apply, or does it, if we are in a kind of post-location-based pandemic when we're thinking about how we interact with partners. I think time will tell. How it interacts with UKRI is going to be fascinating, and the people that run this, because, you know, if you don't have a lot of kind of governance around a structure like this, then you're going to sort of imagine that agency, i.e. individuals, are going to be much greater in terms of how this actually works in practice. So the appointments to its senior positions and boards will be extremely interesting, and those relationships. If we look at the OFS appointments, I would be surprised if there wasn't a similar approach to a kind of semi-political appointment to head this up. I do think it's going to be something quite interesting, and I suspect it'll get quite a lot of international attention as well. And so how this body interacts with the international dimension of research and innovation will be interesting to watch.
I think that's a really big risk, actually, is that, you know, the success of an agency like this, I think, depends on it being free to do radical things and to be independent from government and not to kind of feel in any way obliged to follow the whims of ministers. And of course, I mean, that is broadly the case at UKRI. And if we were to see a kind of quasi-political appointment, I think it would really, you know, tie the hands of the agency, you know, from the get-go. And we saw already this, you know, some of the kind of measures that are being put in place in theory to kind of liberate this agency from red tape and all the rest of it have really hit some buttons around worrying about cronyism and stuff. And I think in some ways this is about timing, because of course we're coming off the back of all the PPE contracts, and so cronyism is a bit of a sort of hot button topic, and actually that charge might not stick in other, you know, in other times, had this agency been, you know, been published at a different time. So I think there's a real need to appoint people who are led by science and who are actually really good communicators, because one of the reasons why we have all these rules, procurement rules, and FOI and all the rest of it is to try and mitigate the tendency of organizations toward, like this, you know, funding distribution organizations toward secrecy and to kind of bake in accountability. Actually, you appoint really good people, you can achieve a level of accountability and public confidence without having to have all these rules. So I think if a smart appointment will be kind of as far away from politics as possible, as close to the science as possible, and very much, you know, ready to talk to people about what's going on and to say, yeah, this didn't work, we're trying something else, you know, let's go for it.
Yeah, I mean, the signs don't bode well, though. I was just looking at the detail of the published bill. I mean, good news is that the government's chief scientific advisor is on the board, so that's Patrick Vallance. Everyone likes to respect him, but it's a small board, 9 rather than the 12 to 15 of UKRI. The chair's appointed by the Secretary of State, but the Secretary of State also gets to appoint the CEO and chief financial officer, And the chair gets then to appoint everyone else. So it's kind of ripe for cronyism, unfortunately.
If I was putting a bet on who might be involved in this, I do wonder whether Kate Bingham might be a decent shout for a tenor on somebody that might head this up, on the basis that they're very much looking at that kind of model of the vaccines. You know, certainly compared to Test and Trace, you've got these two kind of, one went well and one went not so well in terms of this kind of entity. But thinking about other entities in the UK that we might want to look at for how this works and how this works in practice, NHSX is a really good example of an organisation that sort of sits on the margins, has a lot of kind of former special advisors in and around the leadership there, and does things with not a huge amount of oversight. And I do think that there'll be bits of that within the kind of operating things. But you know, there is opportunity within this, and obviously the vaccine task force has worked extraordinarily well for the UK, and so if they can capture that spirit of a mix of entrepreneurialism without the kind of issues that Test and Trace run into in terms of, you know, basic competence, I do think that this might not be a complete disaster.
Time will tell. £800 million there is nothing compared to any of these things you mentioned. I mean, look, I think Debbie's right. I think people are going to want to see results and, you know, exciting breakthroughs, even if we don't learn about them for 30 years. But £800 million is not a lot of money to spend on, you know, reinventing, you know, jet propulsion and nuclear fission and you know, whatever else, discovering aliens and, you know, using their technology or whatever it is they're going to do. We may never know, actually. I don't even know if the 30-year rule will apply.
Well, it's a sort of interesting test case as well for the idea that by reducing regulation, you inspire innovation. And I think, you know, it's a bit of a sort of central tenet of conservative thinking, isn't it? That, you know, but that regulation kind of constrains people. And, you know, there is a strong case for that to be true. But it will be very interesting to see, you know, the regulation also, you know, creates accountability. So it will be interesting to see what the agency does with this lack of regulation, and, you know, what is actually visible, you know, when there's no obligation to produce these kind of turgid annual reports and all the rest of it.
You can read more about ARIA and the budget and everything else on the site. Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
I'm Nikki King, Associate Dean for Education in Engineering, Maths and Physical Sciences at the University of Exeter. This week, I've asked whether A-levels really are the right preparation for study at university, or whether we should unshackle ourselves from traditional prerequisites and look for more skills and motivations required for study at university rather than our perhaps old-fashioned view of core knowledge requirements. Research looking at predictive success in higher education gives a confusing picture, but at Exeter we've done the opposite and shown that you can be successful in degree-level science without having studied the prerequisite subjects at A-level. This therefore raises the question of why we require certain pre-university core knowledge for many subjects. I argue that by being innovative in our first-year curriculum structure and the way we support students in transition, we could widen access to many subjects and mitigate the sometimes poor decisions taken post-16 and the narrow choice of subjects studied. Whilst reform of post-16 qualifications may be desirable, there are things that we can do in universities to mitigate the unintended consequences of the system we have.
Hi, my name is Maisha Islam. I'm the Chief Agent Research and Projects Officer from the University of Winchester, and I know that's a hell of a long job title, but I recently wrote a blog for Wonky titled "BAME Doesn't Help Us Understand Our Students," which essentially adds to the growing debate within the higher education sector related to our over-reliance on the term BAME as an acronym, where I think we have a weird love-hate relationship for it. But the blog really highlights what I've called the sort of under-acknowledged A in BAME, where the experiences of our Asian students have been largely neglected, despite their consistently low levels of satisfaction in things like NSS and the Academic Experience Survey. However, it does really do a shout-out to a report I released earlier this year from the University of Winchester, which collates the experiences of our Asian students in order to inform our understanding of kind of why we were seeing large degree awarding gaps. But I think one of the most interesting and kind of light bulb moments for me personally was, you know, where I come from an Asian background, was this invisible and sort of unlabeled carers some of our Asian students might be, where the love and care and respect that they have for their family unit is a really major importance that may be leading to sort of dual roles being played out where they're not really seeking appropriate support. So I think the main takeaway from the blog is, well, we have, you know, our BME degree awarding gaps that represent one of higher education systemic inequalities. Actually, by disaggregating this term and focusing on our students as individuals, could really ensure effective redressal of these issues.
So this week, USS has published the an update about its valuation. And is this a moment for peace to break out, Debbie?
I think chance would be a fine thing. And as ever, this is really complicated stuff. But the kind of headlines, I suppose, are really quite startling. So USS has begun the process of conducting the 2020 valuation. So the USS scheme has to conduct a valuation every so often to assess the scale of the scheme's deficit, the payments that will be needed to maintain benefits in the future, and all the rest of it. So USS has concluded that the deficit of the entire scheme has increased to between £14 and £16 billion, which is up from £3.5 billion in the 2018 valuation. And we know just how contentious that number was. So the fact that it's close to quadrupling is really quite shocking. And by far the biggest driver for this, about £12 billion worth of that estimate, is the general economic outlook. So the projected returns on investment are much lower than they were in 2018. And this is all to do with gilt yields, which is something that people who know about economics know about. But the bottom line is that the result, if this valuation progresses, USS is saying that the contributions will need to increase, and of course employers contribute part and scheme members contribute part, to somewhere between 42% to 56% of payroll, which is absolutely astronomical. Contributions are currently at 30.7%, which is pretty high, you know, in the first place. And the only reason they're there is because USS agreed to defer the planned rise coming off the 2018 valuation, which is scheduled to rise to 34.7% this year. So, you know, what even the most optimistic scenario has contributions rising really sharply. And of course, UCU has come back and said, you know, this is far too pessimistic, and that USS has ignored some of the key recommendations of the joint expert panel, which was convened to try and manage the failure to achieve an outcome of the 2017 and 2018 valuations. And interestingly, UUK has also suggested that USS needs to justify these high rates. And clearly, you know, UUK is not planning to make the mistake of fighting USS battles again. But I think the thing to remember here is that, you know, we're all set for another enormous showdown, and it's going to be really, really challenging and absolutely bloody. There will almost certainly be industrial action. Employers will be in a really, really challenging position. Scheme members will be, really kind of wanting to know what's going on. And it's all going to be really, really difficult. But I think a key point here really is Nick Hillman wrote a number of blogs a couple of weeks ago and got into some quite heated debates on Twitter as a result. And the thing he kept saying, which I think is right, is that the argument internal to the sector is actually not really the main show. The question is about the pensions regulator and what the pensions regulator will tolerate. There's a lot of work to be done here to convince the pensions regulator that USS can carry deficits on that scale. And if the pensions regulator will not be convinced of that, then all this debate about, you know, who's optimistic and who's pessimistic is pretty irrelevant, actually.
Yeah. I mean, Alex, you're in a USS university. I'm sure you're looking at those proposed rises. And I mean, it's devastating, isn't it?
Yeah. And on an individual basis, I'm not sure how I can afford nappies with that kind of personal rise as well. It's going to be, it is quite eye-watering. I mean, look, a bit of me, and this is maybe naive, is sort of wondering whether the slightly crazy rates being proposed are just a way of making, bringing together UCU and Universities UK. So maybe, you know, Alistair and Joe will together march down to the trustees' office, holding hands and saying, "It's all right. We'll agree on which parts of the JEP recommendations we want to collectively do." I just really don't want this to turn into yet another kind of culture war on campus in terms of our internal narrative about this. I think narrative is the danger here. It is so complicated. It is so fiddly. There are so many moving parts, and you know, even though this is something that is, you know, normally something I have to pay attention to with my job, even I will try and dial out of pension detail when I can. So how that appears to most normal people, and I wouldn't classify myself as one of those in universities, let alone students and everything else, is another matter. And that's where it's quite dangerous, because a narrative about, you know, universities pushing a particular agenda, the regulator pushing a particular agenda, become toxic. So my hope is that there can be a kind of joint approach to this between UCEA UK and UCU, but it isn't feasible for anybody, and so I'm hoping that initial kind of reaction of everyone that this is something that isn't feasible and will damage the scheme far beyond the actual kind of real strength of it, whatever that may be, is a good start, I think. That's me reaching for the Pollyanna take on this.
Mm. I think, I mean, Debbie, is the it seems like there's lots of different kind of arguments going on at the same time, and there are people within UCU who, I guess, looking at it from the outside, I think they can make some progress here by arguing on the detail of how these valuations are conducted and other things, which are obviously fiendishly complicated and require you to hire actuaries and all the rest. But it seems to me that's actually not where the real battle is. There's a kind of much wider industrial dispute here and a kind of much bigger problem with USS. I mean, I have some sympathy with the UCU line that says, well, the chief executive of UCU is paid too much when the scheme is facing such a large deficit. He's on, he's on £500,000 or something.
USS, not UCU, but yes.
Yeah. Sorry, USS.
Yes, I think. Well, I mean, there's a sort of in normal times argument, isn't there, which says that every year the deficit creeps up, and every year, and what's supposed to happen is that employers try and keep the contributions down, and members try and keep them up, and you arrive at a compromise, and nobody's really happy, but everyone sort of soldiers on, and that's sort of how it's always been. And when you're looking at kind of deficits and contributions on this scale, it's actually the whole system of and this is why I think rather than kind of going back to that argument of saying, oh well, these tight-fisted employers won't pay out to preserve our pensions, and then employers saying, oh well, these people are living in cloud cuckoo land, and they get very generous pension benefits, and that kind of classic back and forth that is in, I guess, in normal times somewhat performative, it just sort of stops being meaningful, because you're just thinking, but the scale of the problem is too enormous for that to make sense. And so I suppose you do have to go back to the kind of technical points and say, is the problem really that bad? But even if even with relatively optimistic projections, you're still talking about some quite serious issues, and so it takes leadership of a different sort, I think, not just rallying the troops, but really kind of, as Alex says, sort of thinking about, well, what common ground can we find here? Because actually this is all of our futures to some extent. So we've got to figure out a way through this that doesn't just involve kind of, rehearsing the old arguments.
On Tuesday the 16th of March, Wonky, together with our partners Handshake, will host a Wonky at Home event, Nice Work If You Can Get It, Diversity, Social Capital and Graduate Level Employment. The reality is that privilege still pays, and social background continues to play a role in access to professional opportunities in the UK. Now, with the Westminster government's focus on graduate level employment, there's an opportunity to refocus attention on what universities, working with employers, can do to break down the barriers to diversity in the graduate labour market. At the event, we'll look at student expectations for their future employment, and we'll hear from expert speakers, including Anne-Maria Maffedon, Chief Executive of STEMETS and powerful voice for diversity. So head to wonky.com/events to find out more and book your ticket now.
Okay, so the Office for the Independent Adjudicator has published a new set of case summaries for student complaints during COVID-19. Alex, what jumped out at you?
Thanks, Mark. As ever, Jim has provided a helpful summary on the site, and you can always sort of tell the level of cynicism with which he's approaching things by his choice of a stock image, which is a car crash. The three case studies that have been sort of highlighted are the kind of the thing that many universities are wrestling with at the moment, which is the accommodation refund, and I know students are pretty exercised around that. But also some of the kind of restrictions in terms of particular access to facilities like laboratories, and also going back into the heady days of 2019, never thought I'd look forward to those days, the impact of industrial action in terms of disruption on studies. So providing these examples is both helpful and unhelpful, I suspect, and universities will both be mindful of these complaints multiplying as they have a tendency to do, but at least they have provided at least a bit of guidance, because as Jim points out, the university's minister is very clear in terms of repeatedly saying in her quote-unquote message for students on Twitter that they can actually complain via the OIA if they feel the quality of their education is not there.
Yes, this is a problem, isn't it, Debbie? Because lots of mixed signals coming out of government about what students can complain about and where they can complain to.
Well, I mean, I suppose I wouldn't necessarily characterise it as mixed signals so much as kind of incorrect signals, because...
outright lies. Did we go that far?
I don't think we would go that far. I think, it is true, of course, that if students are unhappy with any aspect of their course, they are absolutely enabled to make a complaint. Should that complaint be not upheld in their internal institutional processes, they can, of course, go to the OIA. What I think is enormously underestimated is all the various things that might precludes that complaint being taken seriously or justified or responded to at an institutional level. So of course, so things like academic judgment, for example, about is one mode of teaching delivery an adequate substitute for another one, and so on. And also just the power imbalances, the barriers that exist to students going through that process. You know, it is an awful lot to ask of a student to take, not only to take on their institution, to shop their lecturers, perhaps in some cases, and then having not, achieved redress through that process, to then take it to, what we know is a kind of a very friendly and lovely and easy to deal with ombudsman, but of course, from students' perspective, they've never heard of the OIA until this moment, and then they have to kind of jump through a whole other set of hoops, and it's not like they don't have other things going on in their lives. So, I think what is definitely kind of reasonably subject to critique is the failure of various regulators and governments to actually set out what is reasonable for students to expect in under pandemic conditions. And to allow it all to be kind of retrospectively kind of worked through by the OIA as essentially kind of creating a sort of subversion of case law that the universities can then kind of have to sort of reverse engineer to try and figure out what they should have been delivering 18 months ago, which, none of that doesn't make sense as a system. And also the sort of, I guess, quite sort of sanguine expectation that if complaints aren't coming through, that means students are essentially happy. And that's not really a legitimate claim to make.
I mean, you mentioned kind of the sort of case law, the acting by precedent. I mean, looking at some of the examples, I guess it speaks to me that the OIA not feeling like they have kind of a lot of reach into these questions. So we've been talking about the dispute over USS, but one of the cases highlighted was about disruption because of the 2019 industrial action as well as the pandemic. The OIA thought, well, yes, it was reasonable for students to complain about all that, but they just gave them £200. So it doesn't seem to speak to me that they have the ability to suggest a lot of recompense in these type of things.
Well, there is, I think, one interesting thing that Jim brought out is that the OIA has come down very firmly on the side of compensation. So that is, money out of universities' pockets rather than a kind of more nebulous concept of fee refunds. So which would be kind of, in theory, taking it off the amount of debt that students owe on graduation. So I think, that is quite a concrete thing. Yeah, the scale of the compensation involved is not always very significant. And I guess the OIA is just using its best judgment as to what the kind of level of challenge and distress has been for the student, and try and kind of put a number on that. And they've got an algorithm that calculates that. you know, again, sort of, you know, that they've sort of evolved to try and kind of manage these really quite unprecedented situations that the sector finds itself in. But the other thing, of course, is that there's another example where the university was unable to deliver, or the mitigation that the university proposed off the back of the failure to deliver practical aspects of the course. This is a lab-based course. The OIA was very clear that wasn't acceptable, that the mitigation has to be both reasonable in terms of will it replace the thing that was not offered, and also accessible in that the student has to reasonably be able to do that as well. So and that student, I think, got rather more in compensation. So there's a clear sort of variation between things that are really quite tangible and things that are a bit less tangible. And I think when you're getting into less tangible territory around teaching quality and that sort of thing, it gets a bit more challenging to really put meaningful numbers on what students have lost out on.
I'm interested, Alex, to the extent to which you're planning for and believe next academic year is going to be more business as usual, and or to what extent we're going to be seeing kind of a long tail of these type of complaints through the next couple of years.
I think we will, and I think it's also the kind of the habit that individuals, because I think the one thing to say is that these, but as Debbie pointed out, a lot of these things are very subjective, and therefore that means that individuals will have individual complaints that are very specific to their circumstances. You know, what a course or course leader may or may not have done in response to this that may or may not be deemed efficient, that may or may not have meant an individual has taken the time to go down the route of the ombudsman. And so I suppose, you know, the long tail question is more connected to whether students get into the habit and are aware of their ability as individuals to do this. So, you know, that you might say that all ties in with this kind of wider narrative as student, as consumer and customer with rights, etc. And so you might be looking at it. I mean, I would finally say that business as usual in September, I've tried to be as pessimistic as I possibly can. So when universities can hold events again, that's when I would classify this as business as usual. And I think autumn is going to be pushing it, if I'm honest, but fingers crossed.
And now we catch up with Mike Radcliffe for Hidden History.
In the 17th century, the big motif is religious intolerance. So The first English university founded after Oxford and Cambridge, and that really gets going, is in It's in Massachusetts. So a group of English people are having a terrible time with religious oppression. So they sail across the Atlantic, which is not a pleasant experience, and they set up Harvard. They attract some money from Mr. Harvard. He gives them the cash. They set up a college where they can be free. They don't want to send their sons back across the Atlantic to Oxford and Cambridge, where they will get a poor religious experience because they won't get the right kind of religious teaching. They're also a bit nervous about sending them across the Atlantic because this is a very dangerous thing to do. So they set up their own college. So you start with a sense of people having their own religious experience. The English Civil War is full of examples of what happens to English universities. Obviously, in both cases, armies camp out in those cities, so that becomes very problematic. As you go through, fellows are excluded from each side. So the parliamentarians will come and chuck out all the high church people. Then after the Civil War, the high church people get back and the Puritans are thrown out again. And we go back through these cycles. It comes to a peak under James II because he starts including Catholics into the Protestant universities, and there's a huge run. And there's a strong case for saying that his behaviour in trying to put Catholics into Magdalen College, Oxford, is the tipping point that induces the rebellion against him and ends his reign. So student politics, or getting students into university, could be said. It's a bit tenuous, but there's a sense of, well, hang on a second, this could be a really big problem. So in terms of the religious conflict, you've got a whole setup of this is really complicated stuff. Oxford and Cambridge are the king's universities. They have become religious in flavour, and therefore getting the right people in there who are going to teach the young becomes very important. So you get various bits of what now seem to be absolutely extraordinary legislation that comes in that sets out who should be in these universities and who's allowed. So the first one is the Act of Uniformity in 1662. So for anyone who's keen on the Book of Common Prayer, this is where that comes from. But it says that any head fellow, chaplain or tutors in any college hall or house of learning, every public professor and reader of either of the universities has got to sign the declaration and acknowledgement. So they've got to sign up to being a Church of England person. If they don't get a license from the bishop, they could suffer the fate of 3 months imprisonment. So, if you don't get the bishop's license, you can be locked up for 3 months. So this is a really harsh penalty on anyone who's in a position saying, well, I want to teach, but you'll get locked up for 3 years. So, after we've had the James II experience, and everyone's very keen that Catholics aren't allowed anywhere near universities, and the test acts are in place, there's a slight variation under that on William and Mary, with the Act of Toleration, which allows dissenters to worship, and they ease off on dissenters, i.e. you know, Baptists and Methodists, are being allowed to teach people at all, and they are allowed effectively to set up what become known in retrospect as dissenting academies. So these are one-man bands to start with. You get a master who will then teach the students. Slowly over time, some of them survive. So they someone else takes it over, and they get kind of corporate status. And some of them get to be really good. So some of them are probably offering a better education than you could get in Oxford or Cambridge, because they're up to date, they believe in teaching science, they're less keen on Aristotle than the Oxford curriculum. So they start to really get going. Now, there's a great project at Queen Mary College looking at dissenting academies, and they reckon there was about 220 of these colleges between the 17th and 19th century. So there's lots of them, and they educate. They've tracked something 11,000 students. So these are getting, in total, probably as big as Oxford and Cambridge are themselves. So some of them are really important. But the fact that they build this demand sets the tone for the beginning of the 19th century, and effectively the sense that, why are we excluding dissenters, so good Protestants, why are we excluding these people from universities? And it sets the kind of the background for what will become the University of London and University College Cambridge and King's College. So you get a beginning point, so you get a kind of sense of we're going to take these things forward. But people, you know, big name people like Joseph Priestley, they come through the dissenting academies. This is the best place in England to get a top class education. If you want a top class education otherwise, certainly by the 18th century, you've either got to go to Belgium or you've got to go to Scotland, because what happens at Oxford and Cambridge is effectively you're joining a hunting club with a lot of booze attached, because there isn't much education going on. And generally there's a sense from scholars that everything is kind of a bit fallen apart by then. But they come right in the end to become the beacons of excellence. But I do enjoy when people talk about 800 years of excellence, which appears in some of the mottos. There's a kind of, except for the 18th century when we didn't do anything.
Okay, so we got the interesting comments from Michelle Donlan, Universities Minister, about decolonising the curriculum last week. It sparked something of a national debate about this very issue. Debbie, what on earth is going on?
Well, it's a kind of classic case of we can all have a lot of fun kind of taking apart what Michelle Donlan said. For the purposes of this podcast, I thought I'd better go back to what she actually said. And what she said, this was in a podcast, a Telegraph Politics podcast, talking about freedom of speech and history. And she said, with university curricula, what's important is that you put things in. So it's absolutely fine to add new things. And you know, things that might have been overlooked in the past, new perspectives and all the rest of it. But what she's got a problem with is taking things out. So removing key text from reading lists. And she said that was a very dangerous and odd road to go down. And she called it sort of censoring history and whitewashing history. I think, you know, and I suppose what she's talking about is, I mean, and again, it's one of those things where I've not heard of instances where universities have removed texts from reading lists because they are deemed to be offensive by contemporary standards. But, you know, it may be happening in a few isolated cases and being spun into a bigger picture. But I think the principle is actually fine. I think it's very hard to disagree with the idea that you shouldn't kind of remove things and say, we're not going to let students read that because it's offensive. That seems a bit of a stretch. And you know, and Donlan, of course, says, by all means, put things back in, widen out the debate. That makes complete sense. Where I think there's a problem with what she said is that if you follow that logic, degrees would essentially have to last 20 years because you could only ever put things into the curriculum and you could never take anything out. And actually, I think what it fails to recognize is that you know, the construction of a curriculum is essentially a curatorial exercise. You know, you do, you have to be selective. You foreground some things, you push other things back. And those choices relate to learn, you know, delivering on learning objectives and achieving kind of wider, I guess, you know, learning outcomes for students. And the other thing is, as Larissa Kennedy, NUS president, pointed out this week, I mean, it's really cheeky misrepresentation of the decolonization movement, because the decolonization movement is actually, is very much about putting things in, bringing in voices, perspectives, experiences that have been whitewashed out of history. Because, of course, while the curriculum is a curatorial exercise, it is not an unbiased one. And historically, choices that have been made may tend to perceive certain voices, working class voices, voices of women, you know, gender diverse voices, and all the rest of it, as just being less important to the sweep of history. And one of the things that and voices from the margins of empire, particularly, and so bringing those voices back in, trying to understand what life was like and how people lived and how they experienced history from those perspectives, is absolutely what Michelle Donlan is talking about, which is enriching the curriculum. So, there's a bit of a circular argument going on here, I think.
I mean, that's admirably balanced, Debbie. Alex, I have a stab at asking this question of virtually every guest, almost every single week. Give us a stab at telling us why you think Michelle Donlan cares about the history curriculum at universities.
It's because she gets to make the kind of broad political point that gets her the support in that particular part of the Conservative Party.
Yeah, which is what is the political point, do you think?
It's just another extension of the same kind of things that Donald Trump has been going on around, you know, the woke lords trying to take that any nature of national pride away from the countries and individuals within them. And, you know, sometimes there's a bit of that has a resonance, and, you know, this focuses on individual events or individual examples, but it's the construction of a narrative around that which is not based on any semblance of critical mass of activity that just I think the last time I was on here you were winding me up about it as well, or Jonathan Simons was, but it's just playing to the gallery. And, you know, universities can either ignore it and then it'll get into the legislation, or we can get cross about it and it'll get into the legislation. Nothing we can do really makes any difference. And so, you know, from our perspective, I think it's just a case of trying to kind of get on with it and not get too worked up by Michelle playing to the crowd, because does she really think any of this stuff? I don't know.
Or is she just being a good foot soldier in the culture war?
Yeah, we'll just wait for Gavin Williamson to leave DfE, and if that happens, and then I hope it might calm down a bit, but yeah, we'll see.
So
I think it would be, I mean, to, you know, talk about a chilling effect, I think it would be really chilling if the motivation of academics for, you know, selecting certain texts was to come under question. I think, you know, that feels very much like, you know, the thought police coming to sort of say, well, why did you not use that biography of Churchill and instead use this one? And the answer might be, well, actually, it's more accessible in the university bookshop. You know, there may be many, many reasons why academics choose one thing over another. And I think, you know, the thinking around decolonization and diversity and inclusion is absolutely part of that picture, but there are lots of other things going on there. So it's really not for government to be saying, trying to kind of see into the minds of academics and trying to sort of structure their choice making in that way.
No, I'd agree with that. And I think, you know, so it cuts both ways. I think as long as, you know, it's fine to raise the issue of the decolonization of the curriculum from one side, just as it's fine for you know, commentators and even politicians, albeit I would say not in their kind of formal capacity as ministers, to try and discuss, you know, from their perspective as well. I think, as you say, as soon as that starts to move into the realms of legislation and making people do things, that's where it starts to get really, really difficult. And I would do that for, you know, I would say that applies from both sides. So, you know, the problem is it just then becomes one side having a go at the other, and everybody in the middle just sort of puts their hands over their heads and hopes it all goes away, which I think is probably not for the way that we should want a political discourse around universities to sort of operate in this UK, in the country.
Agreed.
At the moment.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to delve deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes, or head to wonky.com to find out more about our range of brilliant subscription services, keeping you and your organisation one step ahead of UK higher education policy every single day. Don't forget, you can subscribe to this very podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen, or find the feed you need on wonky.com/podcast. So thanks to Alex and Debbie for joining me today, and for the production support by Jim Dickinson, Matt Grogan and the rest of the team Wonky. The Wonky Show is executive produced by me, Mark Leach, and until next week, stay safe, stay wonky.